which is a collection of poetry celebrating intimacy. Intimacy writ large, and particularly bodily intimacy between a husband and a wife. And it's a text that we have chosen to spend time in because it seems to us, the elders here, that perhaps the way that our particular slice of the world and even we as a community are most upside down is in losing the sense of how central intimacy is to life. There's only one explicit definition of life in the Bible, and it is a definition based in intimacy. Jesus, he says, actually in a prayer, that this is life, that people know God the Father and his Son, Jesus. And that word know does not mean know about. Right? It doesn't mean be able to list several of God's attributes or describe a good theory of the atonement. It means to know the Father and the Son intimately as a member of the family. That's what we were made for. And I would say, based on our day-to-day reality, we actually functionally believe that we're made for avoiding awkwardness and minimizing pain. That we tend to default to that. And that's missing out. And so the Song of Songs is, it's not the most comfortable book to teach from. The whole thing kind of reads like if one of those romantic Disney duets was rated PG-13. You know, not X, it doesn't get graphic and specific, but not G either. You know, it's like if they really turned up the innuendo on a whole new world. So the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5, she says, "Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits." And he responds, "I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk." Yes, all of that is innuendo. No, nothing in my church or seminary background prepared me to think of that sort of thing as like holy scripture. But it is. This exaltation, this celebration of intimacy that doesn't veer into the crude, but also is in no way abashed or prudish about the goodness and the wonder of intimacy. What we're actually going to focus on this morning is the next part of chapter 5, verse 1, right? So they've, you know, Aladdin and Jasmine have been going back and forth and singing together, and then the chorus chimes in. There's this whole group of people who say, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." And today we're going to talk about the role of the chorus, which is they're most commonly in the song called the Daughters of Jerusalem. It's this group of young, not married or not yet married women who are sort of frenemies with the wife in the story. Right? And what are they doing here? Like, part of what makes A Whole New World romantic is that it's just Aladdin and Jasmine off on the carpet. There's not an audience. But in the song, there's an audience. So if you weren't uncomfortable already, I blocked out almost all of Thursday and Friday to prepare to teach on what an audience is doing in the middle of a song about sexual love, and then I got really sick on Thursday morning, And so this is not going to be the most thoroughly prepared sermon, and we're going to pray right now. Father, you made us for yourself, to know you and to know that we are known and seen and loved by you. And, like Paul said in Romans 7, some part of us longs for that, and yet we end up succumbing to the other part of us that's terrified of that and runs from it. And we want you to overcome our fear, our awkwardness, our discomfort. We want you to overcome our sin and self-consciousness and draw us further up and further in to your love. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our God, our rock, our redeemer. Amen. Yeah, so what are the daughters of Jerusalem doing in the middle of this song? I can tell you what it's definitely not, is contributing much good. So they have some less bad moments in this song, but they don't have any really good ones where they sort of offer compassion or wise counsel. Their presence is not a signal to us that we should be letting others speak into our most intimate relationships. You should be doing that. You can find that in lots of other places in the Bible. But that's not what the daughters of Jerusalem are about here. They're at their best, they're kind of overly excited for the relationship. And at their worst, they're kind of envious and undermining the whole situation. They're not in the song to give. They're in the song to receive. Their presence as an audience to the man and the woman's intimacy is a presence that's meant to bless them. They bear witness to this duet of love the way Dave and Catherine bore witness to Les Miserables yesterday. They didn't go to bless whoever was playing Valjean or Javert. Right? They went to receive, and it sounds like you did, and that's wonderful. Right? The daughters of Jerusalem are in this same role of receiving the gift of knowing something of other people's intimacy. That's what's going on here, right? Now, I don't want to overstate it, right? They don't have backstage passes. Right? They don't get to see and know everything. Right? We know that from their title, the Daughters of Jerusalem. Right? Throughout the song, there's this repeated motif of the city, Jerusalem, is a place that's not conducive to intimacy. The actual scenes of intimacy throughout the song, they take place either in a secluded bedchamber or out in the wild, in a vineyard, in a garden, in a forest glade. They don't take place in Jerusalem per se. Right? So there's these young ladies who are kind of a part of the society of Jerusalem. By the very nature of where they are, right? They don't get to see everything, right? And they kind of want to, and at one point the husband rebukes them for being too pushy. So if you have your Bible, you can look at the last three verses of chapter 6. All right, so the woman says, "I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley." That means she went to the place where intimacy happens, where she and her husband can be one, right? "To see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsman, a prince." So she's gone off to enjoy her husband's company. And the daughters chime in here in verse 13. They say, "Return, return, O Shulamite." The Shulamite is the woman. "Return, return, that we may look upon you." Like, they want further in. They don't want the woman, the Shulamite, to leave them behind and go to her husband. Right? They're not satisfied with the amount of access they have to the husband and wife. And the husband chimes in, "Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies?" A dance before two armies is a metaphor. Right? He's saying, "You don't have any business here. This is me and her time. Off you go now." So this isn't unfettered access. And what's going on here is that the song is honoring the sacredness of any intimate relationship. Any intimate relationship is sacred. For something to be sacred, that means it's essentially good and set apart. Any intimate relationship is essentially good and set apart. Essentially good, not just like good the way that tried and true coffee is good, right? But essential, necessary. Right? You can exist without intimate relationships. You cannot live in the real Jesus definition of life without intimate relationships. They are necessary for living. And they are meant to be set apart. Not just open for public viewing, but distinct. This is, yeah, it's an endorsement of date nights and anniversary trips. Those are good and necessary. But this doesn't just apply to sexually intimate relationships. Remember, kind of the whole premise of the Song of Songs is that the sexual expression of intimacy is just one particularly clear window into the depth of relationship that we were made for. So a friendship, if it's going to be genuinely intimate, needs to be in some way set apart, needs its own sacred time and space. My mom has been friends with a woman named Jean since before I was born. And since I was 5 years old, she and Jean have not lived within 500 miles of each other. And so they have a Tuesday afternoon phone call, right? Which, unless one of them is outside of access to a telephone, they catch up for an hour or so on Tuesdays. Right? They've created that sacred time to honor the relationship. And that phone call is not available to anyone, right? I can ask my mom about it. She likes when I do, and she'll summarize. But I do not get to get on like a three-way call and listen in. There's a boundary there. And the daughters are experiencing that. They don't always like it. But they don't get to come all the way into the marital relationship. But they do get to come a lot further in than we might allow, than we might like, right? They're present throughout the song, right? They get to hear all about this intimate relationship. And what's going on here is that, yes, all intimate relationships are inherently sacred, but they are also meant to be shared. They're not meant to grow insular. There's no point in the song where the husband and wife say, "Let's go off to the vineyard and never come back. We'll just enjoy one another and keep everybody else out." Intimate relationships, they're meant to be sacred and to have some boundaries, but those boundaries are meant to be porous. The best picture of this, the highest and most wonderful picture of this, is the relationship between the Father and the Son. The most intimate relationship in the universe, the most joyful, ecstatic, erotic in the true sense of erotic, meaning a love that is deep in longing and delight, that like the deepest eros in the universe exists within God, between Jesus and his Father. It doesn't get any more intimate than that. And yet, Jesus comes to earth in order to put that relationship on display and invite us into it. John, when he's like, he's got this, it's often called the prologue, this sort of opening paragraph in his story of Jesus' life that's meant to be a kind of, here's why Jesus did it. And the climax, the end of that prologue is, no one has ever seen God. No one's ever really known him. But Jesus, who dwells, and the Greek says, in the bosom of the Father, entirely intimate with God, has made him known. He's brought that intimacy into the world and put it on display and invited us into it. Right? And Jesus, he walks this line where he honors the sacredness of the relationship. He's always going up onto a mountain for the night to pray, to just commune with Dad and enjoy the intimacy of that relationship. And he gives us a few glimpses into that prayer life. Right? We know something of what those nights were like. Right? We can read about what it's like when Jesus talks to his Dad in perfect intimacy in John chapter 17 or in Matthew chapter 26. We can read what it's like when the Father talks to his Son in Mark chapter 1 or in John chapter 12. So we get these glimpses, but we never get a play-by-play. There's nowhere in the Bible that says, and then Jesus went up onto the mountain for the night to pray, and here's the transcript. Here's everything he said. Here's how his Dad responded. We're invited somewhat in, but not all the way in. Their intimacy is sacred and meant to be shared. And every intimate relationship you have is the same. Whether it's with a spouse, if you're married, with a parent or child, a friend or a sibling, a coworker, your relationship with God, every single one of them is sacred and meant to be shared. Not one or the other. There is only one time in the song where we get to see the power of this sharing in action. Right? Mostly, the daughters of Jerusalem are kind of ditzy. They just sort of bob along in this shallow, like, they seem very concerned with comparison and status. The most common thing that the married woman, the Shulamite, has to say to them is, like, she says over and over again, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Right? Which is her saying, like, you guys don't get it yet. You think that getting married is a change of status, that you get something out of it, and that's why you do it, which means you're not ready to really receive the goodness of full bodily intimacy. Right? And they kind of stay there. She's still saying that to them in chapter 8, the last chapter, all over again. She has to say, look, you're not ready for this. But there is one time where the daughters, seeing the intimacy of the husband and the wife, actually seems to change their hearts, has a real effect on them. And it's in the poem that we focused on last Sunday, which is most of chapter 5 and the beginning of chapter 6. This is the part of the song where intimacy goes awry. You might remember this is the one where We don't understand the details, but the husband, he seeks out his wife, and for some reason, she turns him away. And then there, they experience this stark alienation from one another. So she says in verse 6, in the aftermath of this, I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. This is the only time where she bears witness to her intimate relationship not just being great, not being a nonstop party, where she acknowledges something has gone really, really wrong. And notice she turns in verse 8 with the familiar, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. But this time she doesn't warn them to wait until they grow up. This time she says, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love. She's asking for their help, which is the only time this happens. And initially, they respond really badly. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? What's the big deal here? Settle down. Probably what's going on here is they're jealous. She's been going on and on about how wonderful her marriage is, and they've been rolling their eyes and grumbling to one another as soon as she turns her head. And finally, they have the opportunity to gloat a little bit. But she takes their questions seriously and launches into this description of all the ways her beloved is more to her than any other beloved could be, right? Starting, my beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000s. And ending in the second half of verse 16, right at the end of chapter 5. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. And here's where you see them change. Here's where you see them actually grow up a little bit. They respond again. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? They go from mocking her to asking how they can help. They go from holding the possibility of a genuinely intimate relationship at arm's length to wanting to do whatever they can to support that love and restore that intimacy. This is where I wanted us to get. We need to receive what the daughters of Jerusalem are receiving here, which is the gift of someone else's honest, vulnerable intimacy. As long as the Shulamite, as long as the young woman is singing about her marriage as if it's one long honeymoon, it doesn't really affect the daughters of Jerusalem. But when she gets honest about the hard parts, when she's frank and vulnerable about the alienation she experiences, even in her best and most intimate relationships, but doesn't lose hope, then her intimacy becomes a blessing to those around her. Vanessa and I got married right out of college, and we're both children of divorced parents. Neither of us grew up with a really good, realistic picture of what marriage can and should be, which means that we brought our own dysfunction and misconceptions, not just into the bedroom, but into all aspects of our marriage. The church we joined the first year we were married was pastored by a couple about 10 years older than us, and they welcomed us in. Our house was a like 400 square foot apartment, so we always had dinner at Josh and Jesse's house. I'm gonna guess 100 times. Wait, no, 4 years, more than once a week, 300 times. Right? And enough that, you can go over to somebody else's house for dinner, and even if they welcome you in and you get to sit in their home, right? Like, anybody can play nice for an evening, right? Nobody can play nice for 300 evenings. So, like, we got to see the real character of Josh and Jesse's marriage and their family. They had their son Davis was a toddler when we first met them, and then their daughter Jo was born while they were in North Carolina with us. Right? That was the first time that we got to see people who were raw and vulnerable, right, who hurt each other in front of us with their words and their silences, not because they were, nasty or trying to, just because you put two sinners in a marriage, there's gonna be hurt and alienation. And we got to see that without them giving up, without them resorting to trying to explain to one or the other of us why it was all their spouse's fault, without them pretending that this was like their last bad day, and they were just one really good prayer away from perfect harmony for the rest of their natural lives. Like, they shared with us some of what was sacred between them without pretending that it was perfect, and without letting all that was not perfect about it overwhelm them. And that, like, nobody has ever given the Washburn marriage a better gift than that. When we are vulnerable, honest about the real character of our intimate relationships, we give those around us the opportunity to believe intimacy is really possible. If you keep your intimate relationships private, hide their essential character from the people around you, they have no opportunity to learn from you. And if you pretend, no, really, we got married and now we're living happily ever after, you let the people around you who are more credulous and willing to believe things will be crushed by trying to measure up. And the people who are more skeptical will just know not to trust you. But if you can engage in this kind of vulnerable, honest, hopeful intimacy, the hope of those around you can be renewed. We are made for intimacy. And we live in this world of alienation. And we can still grow up in love. We can still mature in intimacy, but growth doesn't happen automatically. Right? My kids are growing rapidly, but only because we keep giving their bodies what their bodies need to grow. Right? Cut off the food supply and growth will cease. You can grow spiritually. From wherever you are now, you can grow in the actual life God offers. A life of unashamed, joyful intimacy in relationship with Him and in relationship with those closest to you on earth. But it won't happen automatically. Your soul needs food just as your body does, and your soul lives on love. Those are the calories of the Spirit. You can't generate it within yourself. You need others to show you that it's possible. And you need God to provide it. This, I think, is so cool. Remember that the husband and the wife, right, they represent a human husband and a human wife in a human marriage, and they represent Jesus and his people in an eternal spiritual marriage. And here we have the woman in chapter 5. You and me, the church, the people of God, saying what I'm actually experiencing right now, not I had this one experience many years ago and it bummed me out, but I'm over it, but what I'm experiencing right now between me and God is alienation. Right. Read verse 6 again as your pastor describing his recent experiences of prayer. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. Anyone here ever prayed and it goes like that? I asked, and I asked, and I asked. And I heard a deadening silence. And then the people around her, the world around the church says, what is your beloved more than another beloved? What's so special about Jesus? The world is bursting with gods who don't answer prayers. Move on to someone else. But her willingness to say, my beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. This is my beloved and this is my friend. I can't find him right now, but I know him and I trust him and he will find me again. That's the only thing that changes the minds of the people bearing witness. If you count yourself a Christian, listen to me. This is to be the character of your testimony. When you tell people what your relationship with God is like, talk about it this way. Don't hide it. Don't pretend everything's fine. Say, sometimes it's wonderful. Sometimes the pain and the loneliness is more than I can bear. But I know who Jesus is. And I trust him. That's the story that we have to tell. It's not a story of everything being fine all the time. It's a story of real intimacy, of a real relationship with a real God that goes up and down, sweet and sour. But it's true and ends well. This is the story that we are given. When Jesus comes to earth to put on display the intimacy that exists between him and the Father, in order to pass it on to us, in order to not just have it be something that looks really pretty but that we know we could never attain, but something we can share in. Jesus has to become as vulnerable gets. He has to experience more alienation, more pain and loneliness than anyone else ever has, in order to give us his kind of life. Jesus has to die our kind of death. And he does. And that's what actually changes people. If you've read the stories of Jesus' life, he has his own daughters of Jerusalem. They're called the disciples. And they're pretty ditzy. They have some less bad moments, but mostly they don't get it. They think the whole thing is about their status and comparison and who's going to be closest to the throne when Jesus kicks the Romans out. And it's only after Jesus exposes himself to death, it's only after Jesus has been alienated in their place and still celebrates his relationship with the Father, that they start to change. That's the story that makes them new. That's the story that's making us new. That's the story we get to tell that makes the world new. The intimacy that you have between you and God, between you and your spouse if you're married, between you and whomever, is a sacred thing. But it's not just for the two of you. We all need it. And we gather here each week to worship the God who's given it to us in Jesus. Let's pray. God, you made us for life. Don't let us settle for survival. You made us for love. Don't let us settle for being polite. You made us to be naked and unashamed. Don't let us settle for being pretty well dressed and not that embarrassed. On our own, we're ditzy and empty and trying to cover it up. We need you to fill us with your love. Make us whole and make us new. Please, Jesus. There's nowhere else for us to go. Give us the life we can only find in you.